Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-5026. Joyce M. Hill, Appellant versus Jamie Rappaport Clark, Director, United States Fish and Wildlife Service, et al. Mr. Carl for the appellant, Ms. Durkee for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. We ask the court to reverse the ruling by the district court that the government's position and the underlying litigation was substantially justified. As the court knows, it's the government's burden of proof to carry, and we submit they failed to carry their burden of proof. The court's required to ask the question, why did the government lose? We submit the government took an unreasonable position, both in the regulation and in the district court, a position that conflicts both with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the underlying statute. This court's prior opinions offer some guidance, and we believe substantial guidance in resolving the reasonableness of the government's position. The first opinion was this court's opinion in the underlying Hill case, and in that opinion, the court held that the statute was as plain as Mrs. Hill suggests, that the Secretary's argument was specious, and that it rested on a convoluted and strained attempt to find ambiguity where none appears, and that the court held that indisputably the Migratory Bird Treaty Act included mute swans. The court wrote that we can find no ambiguity in the treaty. In the Fund for Animals, I believe this is a case, Judge Garland, that you were on. You discussed the Hill case and said that the government's position was not reasonable when measured against the statutory text, that the statute covers birds included in the terms of the convention. And again, citing Hill, that the Canada Convention indisputably includes mute swans.
The opinion in the Hill case said that the government's reason for not including the mute swan under the protection of the treaties and therefore the act was that it was not a native species, was aggressive and territorial, and it might affect other treaty obligations and statutory obligations to the Secretary. Now, they're pretty strong arguments. The mute swan was not introduced to the United States until after the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was passed, right?
Oh, Your Honor, it was our submission in the district court in this case that there is fossil evidence and other evidence indicating that the mute swans preceded the introduction of
domesticated, but it didn't become a non-domesticated, non-native species until after the act was passed. I don't think there's any question about that.
We submitted some of the historical data to the district court indicating that there was a dispute of fact on that point, Your Honor.
Even if there were, the question is whether the government's position was substantially justified. These are pretty good arguments, and you may have arguments against the government's position, but it sounds to me like it's hardly frivolous. Now, what did the Court of Appeals say, our court say, in response to those arguments? Did it say that those arguments are not substantial?
Yes, Your Honor. The word was specious at the panel.
No, that's not what the court said. The court said, we have no idea whether these arguments are pertinent, and if so, whether they're compelling. I didn't say they're specious.
Your Honor, the panel's analysis was that there was no ambiguity in the underlying treaty, that the treaty covered all migratory birds, that mute swans were migratory birds.
By the way, there are authorities that indicate that even the non-domesticated mute swans in the United States don't migrate. What evidence was there in the record that they even migrate?
Oral argument, according to the opinion in the first Hill case, the government acknowledged that mute swans were migratory birds.
Well, what evidence was there of that?
There was evidence.
I've looked at studies that indicate they don't migrate.
The evidence was that some mute swans, in fact, migrate, and some of them migrate from Canada to the United States, and they
do. Maybe those living on the you know, the border with Canada may fly over and back, but there's no, I saw no evidence of any vast migratory movement by mute swans. So.
I don't know that the migration is how vast it is.
What flyway did they use?
They used the Eastern Flyway, Your Honor. That was my understanding.
The Eastern Flyway?
Yes, Your Honor.
What if they're in the west?
I understand that there was some migration of the birds in the western part, but you know, for the an oral argument, the
Here's the way I look at this case. I think the government made substantial arguments. This court did not resolve those arguments. Said we can't tell whether they're compelling or not. Instead, the opinion of the court by Judge Edwards said, but this statutory interpretation is not reflected in any of the materials that were put before us in the administrative record. The administrative record was silent with respect to why mute swans weren't covered. And therefore, the court said that we're not going to consider it, and the secretary loses. Now, there is a legal proposition embodied in that statement of law that when an agency puts forth an interpretation of the statute, whether we accept it or don't accept it under Chevron, it depends upon how strong the reasons are that the agency gives for that interpretation. That legal proposition is debatable. There are cases in this circuit going both ways on that question. Does an agency have to justify its interpretation of a statute? Does our acceptance of it depend upon how strong the agency's, so on and so forth? Now, if that's not a substantial government position, I don't know what is. We've got a split in our circuit on the question, and we've got arguments the government puts forth that the court doesn't resolve.
Well, in the Fund for Animals case, this court said that there's nothing in the statute, there's nothing in the treaty, there's nothing in the administrative record to support an exclusion for non-native species, and that in part was indirectly confirmed because the department went to the Congress and they asked that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act be amended to allow the secretary.
That doesn't confirm anything. All that means is that they're overruling the opinion of this court. That's all.
Yes, Your Honor.
It could prove that the court got it wrong.
But it's also based upon the assessment that under this court's decisions in Hill and in Fund for Animals, that there was no basis for distinguishing between native and non-native species, that the secretary did not have the authority under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and under the Canada Convention to make that distinction.
No,
and that the secretary was...
Do you consider this... let me give you an argument, and whether you agree with it or not is not the question, and whether it would prevail is not the question. But suppose, you know, hawks migrate. A lot of people don't realize that. Hawks migrate, eagles migrate. But suppose a non-native hawk is introduced, some falconer gets these things, and they're released to the wild, and that hawk goes and starts, in the migration, kills native songbirds by the hundreds. It feeds off of songbirds. This is not too hypothetical a question. Are we to say that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act protects that hawk, that non-native hawk? That's a self-destructive interpretation. You're trying to protect the songbirds and the hawks killing them.
For the period prior to the passage of the amendments that followed the Fund for Animals and followed the initial Hill decision, the secretary did not have the discretion or the authority under the treaty or the statute to distinguish between protecting non-native species and native species.
But
I'm
asking whether that's a substantial argument.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because the statute and the treaty say what they say, and this court held that there's nothing in there that would support the secretary's position.
Okay.
If I may, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Durkee?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Ellen Durkee from the U.S. Department of Justice. I represent the federal defendants. This court should affirm the denial of attorney's fees under EJA because the district court did not abuse its discretion in concluding that the government's position was substantially justified. The district court also did not abuse its discretion in holding in the alternative that an award for Mr. Carl's work should be denied because they did not demonstrate the requisite attorney-client relationship to justify an award of fees. With substantial justification, I'd just like to highlight a couple of points. One is that the sole issue on which Hill prevailed on, and that is the question whether MBTA and treaties covered a non-native exotic species, was a novel issue that had never been addressed, and it was an issue, obviously, of first impression. This court in Tauscher versus Brown-Hruska, in affirming a district court holding of substantial justification, put particular emphasis on the fact that the case there involved an unsettled question that ultimately was resolved in favor of the government. But there was considerable stress that the government position was not at odds with controlling case law and therefore did not fall into that category of cases in which the cases had shown the government was not substantially justified. So I think that is one element that strongly supports the district court's decision here. Second, in terms of this court's holding and the district court's holding on the merits, I think it's important to recognize that both the district court and this court accepted that there was some ambiguity on this question. Where they parted ways was on the deference that they gave the agency. But it is not the case. Hill was a fairly narrow decision, actually. The court said they were not going to decide it on Chevron Step 1.
The court said we can discern no ambiguity and assume for the purposes of argument that it would move to the second step of Chevron. It didn't say that there was ambiguity. I'm reading the quote, we can discern no ambiguity. It's hard from that to come to the conclusion that the court thought it was ambiguous.
Then perhaps I misstated. The court did not decide it on Chevron Step 1, and it said that it was going to decide on Chevron Step 2, and I interpret that to mean that it is saying that, at least for the sake of argument, it was going to go to assume ambiguity. And I believe in the Fund for Animals as well, the court recognized that Hill did not turn on a Chevron Step 1 decision. It was a Chevron Step 2. Also in Fund for Animals, this court recognized that Congress in the Reform Act specifically said, in the sense of Congress provision, that they believed that the government's position that non-native species are not covered by the treaties is consistent with the treaties. So I think the Fund for Animals decision was somewhat more measured than the Hill decision, and I think it recognizes strongly that the Hill was not a Chevron Step 1, that it was not unambiguous.
I'm confused. Your view is that we should look at subsequent legislative history to determine whether a decision that occurred before that legislative history even occurred was reasonable or not?
No. I think you should take judicial notice of the Reform Act and of the decision in Fund for Animals. Appellants have argued that
Fund for Animals did not turn on the question at all. It turned only on the question of the meaning of the new statute. It didn't turn on whether the government's position in the first case was reasonable or not.
Your Honor, I'm not trying to say that the court, and I don't have to show for purposes of EJIA that the court was incorrect in Hill versus Babbitt. What I'm trying to illustrate is that because of Congress's pronouncement on this. A subsequent pronouncement, I think, lends support for the reasonableness of the government's position in this case. I think that, you know, this court can take judicial notice of that and can also, because it's legislation, it's not like we're trying to create, you know, point to something that's, you know, outside of the normal realm of what courts consider in deciding cases, and that I think that Congress deserves some credibility, you know, that you have two branches of the government that are most responsible for treaties having a particular point of view. And
there's an old case in the circuit that supports that proposition. that when Congress takes action to overrule a judicial decision, that in a subsequent case, that action can be taken into account in determining the meaning of other phrases that haven't been overruled. And the case is Carter versus Panama Canal Company. I think it's 1972.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you know whether that case said that could establish the meaning of those phrases back before the statute was passed?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with the case, so I'm sorry I can't answer that.
Dealt with the Portal to Portal Act.
Excuse me? I guess the last thing I'd like to just say about the government's position in this case, the court did leave it open, very specifically in Hill, that if the secretary could find some provide explanation, it was possible that it could be upheld. And I just would like to make sure the court understands the way that the Hill case sort of evolved was that there really was no administrative record in that case because of the way that Hill had initiated her complaints. She didn't ask the agency for a petition for rulemaking to change the list of animals or to change their interpretation. And so we didn't have an administrative record to give the court that you would ordinarily have to explain the basis of the rule. And in fact, if you look at her complaint or even in sort of some of the rambling letters that she had sent to Interior, what she complained about was they're considering it an exotic species. She didn't argue at that time that exotic species are properly barred.
When was this case brought initially?
It was filed in July of 1999.
Do you know when the Supreme, what's the date of the Supreme Court's Meade decision, do you know?
I believe it's 2000 or 2001, something like that.
Yeah, I thought so. But the interesting thing is that we have a whole line of opinions in this circuit. This is another thread that I'll let you address, counsel, for the plaintiff here, that say that the position taken by the United States for an agency and interpretation of a statute, even if only explained in a brief, could give rise to Chevron deference, and we accept that explanation and so on and so forth. Well, so at the time this case was initiated, that line of authority is prevalent in our court. Now, it's no longer authoritative because of Meade, but certainly when this case was initiated and the government took its position and took its position in papers before the district court, even though the administrative record was silent, that line of authority would indicate that the district court should have considered, not just ignored, the government's arguments. And like I said to your opposing counsel, when it got up to this court, the argument that Judge Edwards said, well, we can't consider any of these arguments because they're not in the administrative record. Well, that may have been accurate in light of Meade or other cases, but it certainly was inconsistent with this whole line of authority in our court. Is that a question? I don't know. Is there a speech?
I'll say it's a question, and I agree.
Yeah.
Because I think you've stated it better than I can explain, so I won't belabor that. I'd just like to touch briefly on the question. Yes, I'm sorry.
Just on that question, what was it about the statute that suggested that anything would turn on the native or non-native character? The court says, in the case that there's nothing in the statute, nothing in the regulations, I mean, nothing in the explanation that says anything could turn on whether it's native or not. What language in the statute, section 703, would you be pointing to to suggest that whether it was native or not native makes any difference?
Well, I think the way what we were pointing to vis-a-vis the MBTA is that the MBTA does not define migratory bird, and it gives very, very broad delegation to Department of Interior to issue any regulations implementing the treaties. So the ambiguity in the MBTA itself is that it doesn't define migratory birds. The treaties, which then became the focus, because then what the court was really looking at were the treaties and the Canadian treaties. What we had argued in Hill is that the preamble language focusing on the purpose of the statute was indicating that what was, they were concerned with were migratory birds that serve certain beneficial functions. And, you know, taking into account that purpose, exotic birds that are destroying those kinds of function of the other birds was not what the signatories had in mind. Also, in 1916,
migratory didn't include exotic? The language says any migratory bird included in the such bird included in the terms of the conventions, and then lists them, and then the panel says that the family, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Anatidae, is included in the conventions, and that's swans, and that's the end of it. That's what the court said.
Well, that's what the court said, but I think we had some substantial answers to that.
One answer was that mute swans were not non-domesticated mute swans were not in existence at the time that the statute and the treaty were passed, and therefore it is impossible to say that Congress or the president meant to cover mute swans. This, even though they're swans, it reminds me of H.L.A. Hart's hypothetical about the statute that's passed that says no vehicles in the park, and the next day a mother goes through the park with a baby carriage. I mean, anybody with any sense would say, well, it's a vehicle, therefore it's covered. But no, the purpose of the statute is something quite different. And so what's the purpose? You know, what was Congress trying to do? And therein lies the ambiguity.
Yes, and we did make that argument, and that is exactly what Congress took into account when it enacted the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Reform Act was really looking at what did Canada and the United States have in mind in 1916 when they entered into this treaty. The other thing, just even in the text of the treaty, after the family names, there are lists. They say including certain kinds of species, and they do talk about wild ducks and so on. And one of the arguments that had been made was that when you looked at what sort of then in parentheticals of what was included, it was always species that had been native to these countries in the treaties. There really is nothing to indicate that they were thinking about exotic species that are introduced into places.
Judge Edwards' opinion indicates that the plaintiff or petitioner pointed out that there were a number of birds that were listed that were non-native, listed as protected. Which ones were they, do you know?
I don't know, but I do know that in the history of the regulations, at times the list was corrected because species had been put on erroneously. And I think, and they said so.
Starlings native birds?
I don't know. I guess one of the last points I wanted to make about the government's position on the merits in Hill was reliance on the post-ratification interpretation. And we think there's very strong evidence that throughout the history, the 80-some years, that the Interior's position was that non-native species are not covered. And I think the court calls that into question, but I don't think they're, in that case, in that particular area of the decision, I think it's at its weakest. Because when the regulation, for a long time, before it was delegated to Interior, it was just done by presidential regulations. But in the 1960s, Interior did have a regulation that specifically said it's only for indigenous species. There was some change to that, but I think the court misinterpreted what the purpose of that change was. There was some debate over captive native species, whether they're covered, and so it said all birds, including the captive versions of those, but it said only those that are covered by the convention, so it wasn't trying to reach out and get exotic species.
When those regulations were issued, did it explain why non-native species wouldn't be covered?
No, they didn't, Your Honor, but I think it's important to understand that the sort of principle that if you want an agency to address a particular issue, you need to raise it in comments. And no one ever questioned or commented on this particular issue. And therefore, there was not really any motivation or reason for the agency to have to address it as so. Since 1973, which is when they started putting into, you know, regulations, the list of birds, the mute swans had never been included. So, you know, in terms of, you know, you know, the court does take into account what was.
You raise an interesting question. On the one hand, the opinion of our court says that because the agency didn't explain itself, we're not going to consider these arguments of counsel. But your point is there's another maxim, that is, if you don't raise an objection before an agency, or don't ask the agency, or don't make an argument before the agency, we won't consider it.
Exactly. You have Vermont Yankee, you have Public Citizen, all of these cases saying that if you want an issue addressed, you needed to raise it. And, you know, these are notice and comment rulemakings. There was an opportunity to do that. My time is up.
Is there a time limit on judicial review of the Interior's regulations?
Yes. We generally argue it's a six-year general statute of limitations for substantive challenges.
How did this case come within that?
What I don't know, and I apologize, is that I know that there had been amendments to the list. I don't know if they occurred within 6 years of the 1999 filing date. I also, as I was trying to explain, this case evolved. It wasn't filed as a challenge to these regulations. It sort of became an evolving issue in the case. And so, you know, standing here today, I guess I can't say definitively why we didn't raise the statute of limitations, but, I mean, part of it is that, you know, we did a motion for summary judgment which addressed quite a number of issues because, you know, she sued five departments and 16 individuals, and, you know, there was a whole array of statutes and different issues in the case, and we had understood the argument to be a claim that the government wasn't enforcing the MBTA, and so we, you know, discussed that. It was only after they filed their supplemental memo, after we had filed summary judgment, that this sort of kind of got fleshed out.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Does Mr. Call have any time left? Okay.
In our memorandum, supplemental memorandum that I prepared below that's in the appendix, I addressed some of the regulatory history, and the department's position is kind of go back and forth, but it
that's in here, Mr. Corr.
Yes, Your Honor, at 074, talks about the, it's only in passing, the regulations that were in existence in 1973 and 1977, but the 77 regulations define migratory birds as any bird, whatever its origin, and whether or not raised in captivity, which belongs to the species listed in Section 1013, or which is a mutation or a hybrid of any such species. So that, at least the regulations at that particular point in history clearly included the mute swans, and the, you know, the government's position has changed on this over the years. Secondly, as I read the Hill decision, the initial panel decision, this court decided or said that it didn't have to go to step two in the Chevron analysis, but did so out of an abundance of caution. And thirdly, the decision about whether or not the fees or the government's position is substantially justified is made on the basis of what was in the record at the time of the decision. And here you've got a situation where the government goes to the district court and says there are these ambiguities in the treaties. And as I read Judge Kennedy's initial opinion, that's what his analysis turns on. The government gets to the Court of Appeals and they take a different position. They say that the Canadian treaty applies and that there's nothing in the Canadian treaty that would justify the secretary deciding that he was not obliged under the law to protect the mute swans as well as other kinds of swans. If there are no further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.